Tonight, before we begin a more formal study of the Pythagorean doctrine of numbers, I'd like to point out a number of points which perhaps have caused confusion in the public mind. Pythagoras used number symbols almost exclusively as hieroglyphical figures to represent essential phases of universal law. It is not known to what degree he was involved in what we call today numerology. It is not certain that Pythagoras himself practiced divination by numbers. It is possible that he did so, but by no means is it proven. The scanty records that have survived would seem to indicate that numerology developed considerably later, and sometime after the death of Pythagoras and his legitimate disciples. The association between letters and numbers is possible in the Greek alphabet, in which letters are used in pagination and in place of numbers in many instances. We know there is a peculiar divinatory device called the Wheel of Pythagoras, which shows, apparently, the numerical equivalent of letters, and vice versa. This wheel, though attributed to him, is not with absolute certainty associated with his name. He is said to have possessed a wheel of letters and numbers. But whether that which has survived is authentic, we do not know. It would not be likely that the Pythagoreans would have used numerology in the popular way in which we have been inclined to employ it. It is more likely that this system developed after the decline of the great philosophical schools. The relation between letters and numbers exists not only among the Greeks, but in various parts of Asia. And a Kabbalah of number-letter associations will be found in a number of systems. But we cannot say with certainty that our present numerology is Pythagorean, nor can we bridge the unfortunate difficulty of language changes, inasmuch as the letters of our alphabet do not correspond with those of the Greeks closely enough to justify following their rule and transposing it to our modern alphabet. Thus we may say that numerology in the practical or popular sense of the term is an entirely different matter and should not be confused with the Pythagorean symbolism of number. To them, number was a very sacred mystery to be used only in the exploration of the great science of wisdom, or the great art of knowing truth. Thus we cannot confuse them, nor can we necessarily discredit the possibility that Pythagoras did have some divinatory concept. The Greeks practiced many forms of divination in his time, and it was customary and usual to form oracles in a number of ways, including from the flight of birds, from the gathering of clouds, from the changing of winds, from the entrails of sacrificed animals, and in many other manners. Pythagoras was accredited with knowing the future, with having a tremendous internal mystical apperceptive power, Therefore, many legends have gathered around him, and many arts and beliefs have been attributed to him. There was a period during the medieval era in human history in which a great number of books were fabricated and attributed to ancient authors. Among these, we might note in passing Aristotle's supposed essay on midwifery, which is not quite authentic. We may also put under the same heading the mysterious sixth and seventh books of Moses, of which the prophet undoubtedly knew nothing. Yet there was a time when catchpenny productions had fascination for the public mind, and wonderful names were associated with some very bad work. This all adds up to these points which we wish to make. Theon of Smyrna, one of the earliest and greatest of the Pythagoreans, does not mention divination in his great thesis on numbers. It would seem that he might have done so had it been part of the original system. It is not recorded by Iamblichus in his Life of Pythagoras, nor is it reported by Plato, although he makes use of Pythagorean number. We do, however, find comparatively early evidence of numerical speculation in relation to divination, but little prior to the 8th or 9th century, so AD. So we have these problems, which we merely point out in passing. Now, for the convenience of those who are interested in classifying materials, I have tried to work out a very simple keyword system as to the Pythagorean approach to number. And as the Pythagoreans particularly use number in connection with archetype or the monadal forms of number, I have followed their system and have selected one word which, as far as possible, summarizes at least a phase of their association between number and power. And therefore, those of you who are interested, I read off this list to you rather slowly so you can copy it if you would want to do so. This is merely a keyword analogy, but perhaps it will assist us in the further discussion of the subject. We will use their form then. Instead of the one, we will say the monad. And perhaps the nearest thing to a keyword is identity. Now, in using it as a keyword, we summarize Pythagorean statements such as the numeral of sameness, or that number which is without dissimilarity, or that number which alone knows itself. Many such statements as this seem to carry the general tone of identity with the several meanings of this word. Our own identity is our own monad. The identity in things represents not only themselves as identified, but also common identity. That the same selfness in each is to be regarded as an identity with all other selfness. So in terms, those things which are of a causal nature, approaching the throne of deity, are said to possess identity. Identity with self. Identity with all self. Identity with deity. And the numeral or the numeration, the monad, carries this thought. The number two, or the duad more completely, is the Pythagorean symbol of dissimilarity. We have already implied that they regarded it as an ill number. They did so because it represents things about which differences are to be noted. It is a number of illusion because difference is illusionary. It is a number of ignorance because illusion, particularly the illusion of separateness, is the root of ignorance. Ignorance is therefore transformed into wisdom to the degree that unity is brought out of division. Therefore, perhaps also the Pythagorean term chaos is appropriate to the duad, whereas cosmos would be more appropriate to the monad. Therefore, dissimilarity is not only essential difference, but the acceptance by the mind of the appearance of difference. Dissimilarity also includes comparison, for by means of it we are tempted to elevate parts above each other and to attempt to achieve to a comprehension of good without overcoming the primary evil, which is division. Therefore, of two or more things we may say, this is good, this is better, this is best. Yet none of these three can be best, because only the one can be best. Anything that is not the one cannot be elevated to a superlative position. Elevation, therefore, in Pythagorean thinking, is motion toward unity. And things divided cannot be supreme, although because of the imbalance of divided parts, one may be greater or lesser than another. Yet always, totality alone is superior to part. Consequently, the duad, as a symbol of separation, becomes a proper emblem of man's division from truth, and separation is appropriately the symbol of interval. Interval between objects is measured in distance. Interval between qualities is measured qualitatively. But wherever interval or distance exists, the duad is inevitable. All lines must have ends. All separate things must have interval. And if interval shall cease, separation shall cease. Therefore, interval becomes the great abyss which man must cross in his effort to be restored to a universal state. To be divided from God is to exist in a state of separation from reality. And separation is a state dissimilar. Thus, in the Pythagorean thinking, among the key words which they themselves have left is this word dissimilarity, which I think conveys a great deal if we want to think about it. We hope that each one of you will think about these words later and see how they are the elements of a very profound series of speculations concerning the nature of being and illusion. Now, the third number, or the archetypal triad, or equivalent to the number three, was to the Pythagoreans the symbol of wisdom. Why is it the symbol of wisdom? Because wisdom is moderation. And moderation is between extremes. Therefore, out of the concept of extremes and moderation, we develop a trident, or a three-pronged instrument. in which the middle point is equidistant from the extremity. This point is wisdom, because wisdom is equidistant from all extremities. Extremities, as we told you in an earlier lecture, are always represented as phases of dissimilarity, therefore are essentially negative. We do not say that good is opposed to evil. This is a dissimilarity that is illusional. We say that two evils are opposed to each other, and that between them is a point of equilibrium, which is truth or reality. Therefore, the cynocephalous ape in Egypt, the symbol of the human mind, is always seated on the beam of the balance of judgment in order that it may represent equilibrium. Wisdom is equilibrium of mind. Wisdom is the ability of the individual to reconcile divided parts by reason. It therefore, such divisions as appear to exist in nature are overcome by the rational power of man, who is able to discover unity as a spiritual experience. To discover unity is to reconcile opposites, and all opposites are reconciled in a neutral state, or a state in which no polarity dominates. Wisdom, then, is equidistant between two kinds of ignorance. Ignorance and wisdom are not opposites, because there are two kinds of ignorance. The first, the state of unknowing, and the second, the state of false knowing. These two, then, must both be reconciled. That which is not knowing must be elevated. That which is wrong knowing must be dissipated or reduced to a common ground. In the same way, virtue is in equilibrium between vices, for there are vices of excess and vices of privation. Each individual, for instance, in an economic situation, can have too much or too little. Both of these extremes are unfortunate. Moderation is fortunate. We also observe that great fortune frequently destroys. Great misfortune frequently perfects. Thus, we cannot place any polarity in this way. Wisdom is the reconciler, the ordinator. Wisdom is represented by triads, because in these we have balance. And a triangle is a balanced form, and is the least form which can enclose an area, the circle always being infinite form. Thus the triangle, if it be equilateral, represents also the primary parts of man, consciousness, intelligence, and force, in equilibrium. And these together constitute wisdom. For if wisdom is, as Socrates said, the recognition of the one, the beautiful, and the good, then it represents a balance in which no part can be deficient without destroying all. Virtues were therefore regarded as triads. The greatest of all virtues is wisdom, because wisdom is the virtue which perfects or makes possible the rational discovery of truth. Thus the term wisdom is appropriate to the triad. Now, the next one is a little difficult, but it requires a discrimination on the part of the student. For the four, or the tetrad, archetypally speaking, is the Pythagorean symbol of intellect, And we come for a moment to pause and consider the difference between wisdom and intellect. We must make this discrimination at this point. The four, in its largest sense of the word, was what the Pythagoreans called the little holy number. And among many ancient people, the four was the symbol of God. The four is the fourth number. If considered in a sequence, following the tetractys, or the groups of dots, the 1 plus the 2 plus the 3 plus the 4 equals the 10. And as the 10 is the most sacred of all numbers, 4 represents the least number by which the 10 can be produced by mathematical sequence, or simple addition. 4, therefore, carries with it the symbolism of the forces or powers in the universe by which the material creation was brought into existence. The 4, therefore, was also called the demiurgic number, or the number of the mental or intellectual regent of the universe. Following the Orphic theology, to which we must refer at this time, we recognize a hierarchy or a descent of deities. We know, for example, that the Orphics represented the supreme being under the name of Uranus, or heaven. That Uranus, in turn, lost the kingdom to Cronus, the god of time. And Cronus, in turn, was dethroned by his own son, Zeus. Zeus, or the Latin Jupiter, thus becomes the demiurgic power. For according to the Greeks, it was Zeus who created the mundane universe and is embodied in it. Uranus created the spiritual universe. Saturn created the psychic or soul universe, and Zeus created the mundane or material world. And therefore, this great material creation is the body of the demiurgus, or the lord of the cosmocrators, or creators of the world. This Zeus is then the third person of a creative triad, and is the power which represents the active principle in nature. The universe being created by will, which is spirit, wisdom, which is the psychic nature, and action, which is the material power. Zeus or Jupiter represents the active or objective principle, or the emergence of life from and in form. Thus he is called the formator, and is so recognized in most systems. Among 72 different peoples, according to the Kabbalah, the name of the deity responsible for creation contains 4 letters or characters. These letters or characters are called in the Hebrew form the tetragrammaton, or the name of 4 letters. And this always implies the third logos, or the creating power of the material universe. The ancients generally regarded and revered the number 4 because it represented the elements, the direction, and of course, when presented in cruciform, represents the 4 arms of a cross, either an actual cross or St. Andrew's cross. The cross was, of course, the symbol of matter or of materiality. And it is therefore the cross upon which the Logos or the Christos is crucified. The cross represents the material world and also bodies and the four instruments of science or knowledge. For the Pythagoreans held that man possesses four powers by means of which he is capable of orienting himself in the material world. We say intellect is different from wisdom, inasmuch as man can think, but thinking does not necessarily imply the achievement of wisdom. The world intellect corresponds to the concrete mind of man. Therefore, the number four represents mind focused in matter, and this is termed intellect, whereas the number three represents mind focused in a superior state, therefore abstract or creative mind. Intellect rationalizes, but wisdom is not possible without understanding, and understanding implies the living, vital experience of a thing. The mind, therefore, contemplates. Wisdom is the production of contemplation plus internal experience, or apperception through psychic power within man's own nature. Wisdom is a state of knowing, whereas the intellect leads to remembering, to thinking, and may also end in dispute or dissension. By mind, man builds the world. By wisdom, he perfects himself. They are not the same thing, although in many respects they may appear to be quite similar. Wisdom represents an attribute of God. Mind represents a limited manifestation of this attribute in man or in some created being having a separate intellectual nature. The Greeks, therefore, use two terms to represent wisdom and intellect. One of these was intelligible and the other intellectual. Intelligible being or knowing is that in which knowledge is inherent and cannot be separated. An intellectual being is one in which knowledge must be acquired or must be the result of some process apart from inherency. Thus, certain orders of superior beings are intelligible because they move from a source of wisdom within themselves. Whereas man is an intellectual because he moves toward a source of wisdom about which and of which he is not yet able to know completely or perfectly. The intellect aspires to attain wisdom. The wisdom principle itself is therefore an end of intellect. When we say the intellect brings with it the possibility of wisdom, we then clearly distinguish between the two states. An individual who has remembered a well-known scientific thesis may be called intelligent, but he is not necessarily wise. For wisdom is a dynamic. Wisdom is much more than thought. Wisdom is possible because man is capable of attaining it. But we may say with Pythagoras that wisdom is archetypal and exists whether there is anyone to know it or not. Thus, intellect depends upon wisdom, but wisdom does not depend upon intellect. Wisdom is a reality in itself. It can perhaps be aspired to by intellect. Whether there be a mind or not, truth remains. And this is the essential difference between the power of the triad and the power of the tetrad. The archetypal five is called the pentad, and this is the symbol of equilibrium in a little different way. The triad is wisdom. The pentad is equilibrium in function or in existence. It is a balance of forces rather than a state of consciousness. All forces and elements in nature strive toward equilibrium. In creatures with certain spiritual endowments, this equilibrium may result in wisdom. But in creatures of another kind, or in orders of life different from those we recognize, there is what is termed equilibrium. And equilibrium is the bringing of dissimilars into patterns, not involving necessarily the dissolution of illusion, but the arrangement of things harmonically or into ordered patterns. The number five is particularly, therefore, the balance of power in nature. Nature is forever striving against excess. It is forever trying to force one group of circumstances against another, so that nothing will predominate. An example of this, I think, is one that I probably have told you before, but it deals with a natural problem and is appropriate this time. Experiments were made, for example, on a certain isolated mesa in the southwest of the United States to try to create an ideal setting for the development of certain kinds of creatures. Because it was almost inaccessible, animal life on this mesa could be rigidly controlled. A group of kindly and friendly animals, to be exact, a herd of deer, was brought to this place, and every animal known to be detrimental to them and every other form of life which they had reason to fear was removed so that they could do exactly what they pleased. They all died. They found that the very forms of life which in many ways hazarded the deer and its survival also kept a kind of balance among themselves, and that the removal of these destructive forces removed also constructive forces, which could not be separated from them. And so by degrees, the balance of nature was destroyed. And by destroying the balance, the very creatures we sought to save were themselves eliminated. We know this is also psychologically true in the case of the human being. There are persons who, in a great spirit of kindliness, try to prevent others from suffering. If they succeed, they generally destroy the other person. In attempts to save children from the necessary experiences of living, for example, we do not preserve purity, so we simply weaken character, and the child becomes incapable of meeting the problems of life effectively. Nature is forever working for an equilibrium, a maintenance of balance. A man, regardless of his good intention, frequently interferes with this equilibrium. So the Pythagoreans, way back at that time, recognized the affinity between the number five and man, as assuming and affirming, therefore, that the number five was also the symbol of the Hierophant, or the master of the mysteries. The Hierophant, of course, being man, the master of nature. Therefore, that it was essential to the place of man in nature that he should strive ever to preserve and advance the equilibrium of the environment in which he existed. This equilibrium not only assured a better world around him, but preserved him. The man exists only because of a balance of forces. If this balance is too gravely disturbed, man will destroy himself. A message which might have some interest to atomic thinkers these days. The universe is therefore appropriately represented in its natural equilibrium by the number 5. And this number, because of its relationship to man himself, was represented as an upright 5-pointed star, the points being composed of the head, the arms, and the legs. This became a magic symbol and was used for the Kabbalists and the later magicians throughout the medieval world. Pythagoras is said to have worn a ring carrying upon it the Pentalpha, or 5-pointed star. This was the symbol of healing, because the purpose of healing is achieved by the restoration of equilibrium. All sickness is an imbalance of some kind. This imbalance may be due to chemical deficiency. But the moment the balance of parts is destroyed, the security of the compound is endangered. Creation remains together because of an intricate pattern of balances. And if any one of these is disturbed, a chain reaction sets in which threatens the survival of anything and everything else. One of the old Pythagoreans said that if man could destroy a grain of sand, he would ultimately destroy himself. Because that chain reaction would lead finally to the absolute annihilation of the world. And he would only have to destroy one grain of sand. But, of course, the answer lies that he cannot do it. That the equilibrium is therefore indestructible. But man does have the power, as the Hierophant, of assailing or endangering this balance. And the Pythagorean symbol of health, therefore, was to restore balance. To restore the balance in relationships in life. To recognize that every inward attribute must be balanced with a manifestation. That words without works are dead. That there cannot be too much of an intake without some giving out, or there will be trouble. That nutrition not only requires food, but also exercise and the use of energy. That wherever there is a blocking or a stopping of the flow of universal life, survival is threatened. Therefore, health, peace, security, world good are appropriately symbolized by the star, which even in the time of Pythagoras was also called hope, inasmuch as to them hope was the promise of good things for those who kept the law. Anyone who did well had a good hope. For hope is nothing more than man's reasonable expectation that that which is good will produce good. Equilibrium and balance maintain all of these things. Now there is a difference between, again, the 5 and the 6, but it is subtle. Like the difference between the 4 and the 5. Because the 6, according to Pythagoras, the heptad, was called the number of harmony. Harmony is, again, a kind of order. But harmony is not so much concerned merely with balance. Harmony contains many other attributes, of which perhaps the most important is motion. Harmony, whether it be of sound or of movement or of color, implies certain motion and a certain vibratory relationship. Equilibrium is the balance of things. Harmony is the equilibrium of things within themselves rather than in their relation to other things. The sixth, of course, to the Pythagoreans was also the number of creation. Creation being, of course, essentially and primarily the manifestation of universal law through the harmonic of generation. So the number six, being composed of two interlaced triangles, one upright and the other inverted, forming a six-pointed star known to the Hebrew Kabbalists as the Shield of David. This symbol was a symbol of union, in the sense of the union of generations. It was the symbol of the generating of the universe. And according to the Pythagoreans, therefore, it was called marriage. It was called union of the positive and negative principles of life. In the Bible, the Old Testament, we hear of the 6 days of creation and the seventh day upon which deity rested. In 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. Six was therefore the number of labor, and the great labor was creation. And creation is the primary work of being, and it is also the primary labor of man. For all things fulfill through creation. And the archetype of creation is the creative act of God itself, or the supreme power. Thus, in the principle of creativity, we also find harmony. Why harmony and creation are linked together by the Pythagoreans may be a little bit obscure, but I think the answer lies in their recognition that creation is ordered or harmonic motion. Creation is a sequential unfoldment or ideation of things from within themselves. In the simple and natural processes of creation, there is no dissonance. There is the dance of life, the magnificent harmony of the spheres. And the very processes of creation are the ultimately natural actions of things. Therefore, the inevitable and spontaneous fulfillment of the purpose for existence is harmonic. It's beautiful. It's orderly. We gain another concept from this thinking in connection with the first chapter of St. John, where we find that in the beginning was the Word. The Word or Fiat, the creative tonality, which we find returning again and again in religious and philosophical systems, in the mantrams or sacred chantings of tones, and in the garlands of letters of yoga and tantra, we have the recognition that creation is sustained by a great harmonic principle, and that the universe is composed, as the Greeks pointed out, of number, color, and form, that all things move according according to these laws. Actually, the six as the symbol of creation is appropriately a symbol of harmony. For there is not a star which thou beholdest, but in its orbit like an angel sings, hymning to the young-eyed cherubim. Always this great Pythagorean overthought of the tremendous harmonic of creation. The creation was a song. The creation was a magnificent unfoldment of tonal beauty that actually whirled with the songs of angels, and that everything that grows and lives is in some way the lengthened shadow of a song. That Pythagoras was a musician, that he had the sensitivity of the musical consciousness, we know, and we can understand why, to him, as to Bach, mountains were set in keys, and various changes of climate and temperature, storms and wind and waves, were point and counterpoint. These things were all part of one tremendous rhythm. A man listening, as Pythagoras did, for the tone of nature, the great Kun of China, the inevitable song that extends and expands and goes on forever. He realizes with Pythagoras that this whole universe is maintained because of a great tonal vibration. Also, that everything that lives has a tone, a keynote. Caruso was able to break glasses by sticking them with his finger and then singing the tone until the glass broke. Glasses and other fragile instruments can be broken by the tolling of a bell. And from the tuning fork, we realize how sounds are carried and can be picked up. Pythagoras, marching with his disciples through cities, played upon his lute the keynote of the great architectural building pattern, declaring that every piece of symmetrical architecture was built around a musical form or pattern, and that if this keynote was emphasized in a peculiar way, the building would fall, even as the walls of Jericho fell when the trumpet sounded when the tribes of Israel led the sacred covenant around the walls of Jericho. So the universe was a great mystery of harmony. And Pythagoras went further to point out that man, seeking the universe, seeking his re-identification, much like in the philosophy of Lao Tzu, but approach by means of harmony, by the harmonic proportions of his own soul, man was able to hear the music of the spirit. By the mysterious silences and quietudes of his own consciousness, he was able or could become aware of the great tone, the great universal note that sustained all things. Thus creation was indeed the blazing forth of sound around which forms were gathered, and every living thing is a sound embodied in a form. These thoughts all relate to the mystery of the number six, which to Pythagoras represented, therefore, the whole mystery of harmony, the whole concept of man's ability to bring himself into harmony. And we have the harmonics of good and evil. We have the harmonics of ignorance and wisdom and today we are beginning to recognize the importance of the therapeutic value of sound and harmony in connection with sickness. We know that when we speak of harmony, we speak of several things. For in a mysterious way, we use one word to cover two grand ideas. One of these covers the concept of sound. The other, the concept of integration. When we say a person is harmonious, we do not necessarily mean that he is singing, nor do we necessarily mean that we hear some sound coming from him. We mean by harmonious that there is no discord in his nature, that he is a concordant person, and that therefore his whole nature is a melody of conduct, a melody of natural motions and emotions, a melody of synchronized parts of function. At the same time, we use the term harmony to represent an advanced form of musical composition, one of the last and greatest forms to be developed. Because we recognize in music three degrees also. We recognize the basic principle of rhythm, which is perhaps the oldest form of music that we know, largely the result of primitive percussion instruments, the drum and things of that nature. Then we recognize melody, which is a continuous story unfolding in tones. We know the Greeks at the time of Pythagoras sang only by melody, and that also that they had no essential keys as we know them, nor did they train their voices in any harmonic arrangement. As one old writer points out, they all sang the same words at the same time, and they sang according to the convenience of their voices. Now that might or might not be particularly delightful to us at the moment. They made no effort to agree as to the key or pitch. They simply spoke musically or with the concept of music. But Pythagoras does receive considerable credit as having introduced the concept of harmony, although it languished for a long time thereafter and did not have immediate recognition. But harmony represents intervals and the recognition of intervals, producing such things as the diapente, the diatessaron, and things of that kind. The intervals of music that are harmonic and enharmonic. This also tells us that harmony has to do with the knowledge of intervals. And this, again, has to do with the ordering and the sequencing of various attitudes. Harmony in music is the ability of two things essentially different to unite to produce a common concord. Thus, individuals thinking and living according to the conveniences of their temperament, may still unite to form a harmonic composition. In other words, things cannot be harmonic that are not identical. And by the very laws of harmony, these differences under discipline enrich the tapestry of tone and make the entire work more interesting, more advanced, and more spiritually satisfied. All these are rules and laws, then, that come under the heptad, but under the hexad. But we must now go on to the heptad, which is the archetypal form or power of the number seven. Pythagoras gives us many keywords, but they are all, I think, summarized in one law. Number seven is the number of the law. Now, by law, the Pythagoreans meant that celestial integration of processes which constitute the inevitable pattern of conduct for all things. In other words, the will of deity is revealed through law, and the way of heaven is given to man through the laws of nature. That which in itself speaks not in words that man can hear reveals itself by conduct, and law is the conduct of God. To the Pythagoreans, therefore, law is the forever revealing book of truth. Laws are of two kinds, divine and natural. Divine laws are those which reside archetypally in the divine being. Natural laws are the reflection of divine law, conditioned within a kind of substance or material, through which all of universal or divine law may not be perceived or apprehended. Only a part of the great law is embodied. The rest remains in its own nature. That part which is unembodied in matter, however, may be embodied in soul and in spirit. Therefore, man advancing from a material state to a psychic state may move under the administration of laws previously unknown, but forever existing. Law is also referred to by the Pythagoreans as the will of God, because by means of law we become aware of the divine will to be itself, to fulfill, or to relentlessly and inevitably consummate its own purpose. For man, therefore, there is no release from law. The universe is lawful, and man, in order to attain to any state of security, must keep the law. Now, in addition to those laws which arise in God and nature, there are laws which are formulated by man himself for the administration of his own society. Most of the great codes of laws have originated in revelation or mystical or religious works. The earliest codes that we have, such as those of Hammurabi, are accredited to deity, and it is believed that they were revealed to prophets and patriarchs and great lawgivers of ancient times. The human history of law is largely derived from the record of things traditionally observed. Most so-called spiritual revelations of law are accumulations of human experience sanctified by time and demonstrated by utility. Thus, even man-made law is only the shadow of his observation of universal law. Now, in the course of time, however, man's civilization becoming more and more artificial and complicated, there has been an increase of statutes, and many persons, not themselves equipped to contemplate the universe, have found themselves either forced or inspired to amend the legal code. The result is today that laws are not always in accordance with heavenly law or universal law. And so the early Christian church divided man-made law from divine law, declaring that to break a man-made law is a crime. To break a divine law is a sin. A sin being an act against God, a crime, an act against man, or against the common good of man. Now, if we go back to our book of Genesis, we find that on the seventh day, the Lord rested and set aside the Sabbath. And in the Kabbalah, the Sabbath becomes what is termed the center of the direction. The universe was recognized in ancient times as having six directions: north, east, south, west, up, down. These directions all came from a central point, and this central point was called the Sabbath, or the great throne. And power, moving into objectivity from itself, extended in six directions from its own nature. And these six directions later became the six faces of a cube, and were so symbolized in the Pythagorean symbolism. These six directions and the center exhausted the potential manifestation of power. Therefore, they represented law or motion. Because to the Greeks, law was also a movement. It was a motion of energy according to its own nature. And when we say according to its own nature, we say law. For this is accord with self, or accord with the essential reality.